But in just a moment, we'll be continuing our study of the history of Israel, specifically talking about 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. Before we get into our Bible study tonight, though, Bobby Williams is going to be leading us in opening prayer. Bobby, would you do that for us, please?
Let us pray. Our Father in heaven, we're so thankful unto you for blessing us to be able to come together this evening and study from another portion of your holy and divine word. I ask that you will help us as we study your word to share with others and cause your kingdom to grow and cause many souls to be saved. I pray for our brothers and sisters who are not with us this evening, and ask that you will watch over and bless them so that they will have a blessed recovery from their illnesses and soon be back with us. I ask your forgiveness for our wrongs and ask that you would help us to repent of them properly. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.
All right, so everyone has that very terrifying looking piece of paper, right? I suspect there's probably some place somewhere where they've tried to sit down and look into how people respond to things. And like for me, when I'm starting to write, the most terrifying thing is a blank page with nothing on it. And so I'm most likely going to doodle in the corner and feel a bit better about myself. When it comes to tests, it's kind of the same way. And you look at a piece like this, piece of paper like this, and you go, is this a test? This is a test, but it's not a test. And so you're not going to be graded or examined on the outcome of it. But I wanted to take just a couple of minutes before we actually start looking at all the maps that we're going to have up above, and have everyone kind of take a look at that blank piece of paper. And especially if you have a pencil, you can do it in pen. And Bill, I think there's one more in the back if you didn't grab one, right on that corner table there. If there's not, we can get a couple more. Look at that map and see if you could put just a couple of big places on it. Maybe Jerusalem, maybe name the seas, maybe another big city or two. The reason I suggest doing that is because you're probably more right than you are wrong. And here's what I mean by that. None of us are going to be geographically perfect in placing these cities. No matter how excellent you think you are, we're not cartographers, right? We don't have the tools that they do to try to hyper-specifically identify both where the nameplate should go, but also the dot that represents the feature we're talking about. But most of us can probably say what region this map represents, right? So what part of the globe is our map? This is Israel, or we might say Palestine if we're trying to be connecting it to a little bit more right now. And this map has some features on it. So what kind of things do you see on the map just by looking at it? And the answer can be, I'll give this one already, squiggly lines. Because yes, there are squiggly lines on the map. But what else do you guys see or note there? So there's some rivers, there's a couple of lakes. They go different directions, but they all kind of seem to go towards one another, right? And we can also say some of these rivers, we might even have some names for them, right? What are some of the known names of this river and the lakes that we see?
Sea of Galilee.
Yeah.
Euphrates River.
Right down below is your Euphrates. In the middle, what connects the Sea of Galilee or Kinneret, which is another name for it? The Jordan, right? And what's the other sea that we've got?
The Dead Sea.
Yeah, the Salt Sea or the Dead Sea. And guess what? You guys know a lot about this map already, right? You know more about it than what's wrong. The challenge for us is that when we're looking at maps like this, we are necessarily often kind of thinking about a very specific detail. Hey, where's that city? Where's this place over there? What's this little thing right there? What's this little feature right there? We've got a goal in mind. Raise your hand if you were to go into a new country right now, or just a new county, and you would be using a paper map to get there. Right? A couple of guys, like we got three or four folks. If we went back in time 30 years, how many of you would have a Rand McNally fold-out map in your car? Yeah, I still have one hiding in my car, right? I traveled from Temple Terrace, Florida to San Jose, California on a Rand McNally. You know, to just drive and follow the routes. No cell phone either. So you think about how that experience goes. So we've shifted our minds. Even if you weren't born in this era, we now all behave that way in this era. And so something to think about with maps. We treat maps now the same way. We use devices for our maps. Paper maps are a little bit more antiquated, but their value still exists. They're still useful to us because most of us, how many went right to the back of your Bible and started looking at this map and making connections? All right? Guess what you did? This is where everything comes together. You pulled out your Rand McNally, opened it up, and started doing the same thing. And that helps you figure out where everything is. This should help you understand that while memorization of facts and details is incredibly important, and it absolutely is, how to use the tool is far more important than memorization of the information that the tool will give you. You know, whatever it is. Because I can give some people a Rand McNally map, and it won't help them at all. They'll just know that they're lost somewhere on that piece of paper versus being lost without the piece of paper. Like, some of us don't have that intuitive sense of direction or the skills to navigate on a map, and that's fine. You just work with what you got and you make adjustments. So you work within all of that to now get yourself to think about, well, how does this have anything to do with the biblical story and what God is trying to teach us? It's the same thing. So Rand McNally, it's valuable because we know how to use it, so we remember how to use it. We know how to work in the back and see the major places. Big cities are listed out there. They'll give you the grid coordinates, you know, the A, the alphanumerical combo of, well, this is in section A7. And you go, there it is. There's what I want, right? Bible's the same way. Bible maps are the same way. You're going to look at and think about it the same way and say, I got this tool in the back of my Bible. How do I use it and when should I use it? If I'm thinking about the geography of the biblical story. Well, it's pretty simple. When you come to a place that you know is near a big feature you're reading about in the story, use that skill and the tool to go back and catch it on your map. So tonight, this thing that's a piece of paper that you thought maybe was a test, it's actually a note-taking sheet. Where as we go through, you can take some notes about places that are interesting to you or interesting to the story. And you don't have the anxiety of a blank page. I didn't like, how many of you were in those classes when you were kids and the teacher would say, draw a map of this, and they just give you that blank page? And you turn back and they asked to draw you to like the state of Texas, and you returned back some sort of eight-legged animal. Like that was me with those maps. I could never get the shapes right. You don't have that. You got everything you need there. Remember this? This is our sequence of how the book lays out. One big kingdom splits into a single separation space and eventually kind of resolves itself to a closing single kingdom at the end. And so that's how the structure of all this is laid out. And so now I'm going to show you, as I kind of scooch forward, this real quick. This is the divided kingdom. You probably have a map really similar to this in the back of your Bible. This kind of typifies primarily 1st and 2nd Kings. And 1st and 2nd Chronicles overlap, obviously. But it shows you where a couple of key important details can be found, such as the names to our rivers, right? And the names to our lake. So you can look up at our big giant map and you can see the Dead Sea. All right? That's a big feature. And by the way, the Dead Sea kind of has a little C shape in it. I don't know if that helps you or not, but any kind of mnemonic that is important to me is always something I remember. But up north, you have the Sea of Galilee. All right? Les might know this. I know Gary knows this. Is there a Bible song that talks about these two seas? That's an easy one. The answer is yes, there's actually a scriptural song in our songbook that talks about day by day the dead gives back to life and how the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee intertwine their existence spiritually and physically. We sing about that in songs. You look through your songbook and you can find a couple songs that use that imagery where one sea is life and the other one's death. I know Alan knows the answer to this question, but what's it like at the Dead Sea? What's it like there? It's an easy one. Everything is absolutely dead. Well, it's like so dead. Every water place you can think about in Georgia right now, to some degree, is teeming with life on the edge of its banks. And some of that life terrifies us. Some of that life fascinates us. And some of that life feeds us, right? And some of that life actually fits in all three categories. Something that terrifies, fascinates, and feeds us, right? When you go to the edge of the Dead Sea, there's nothing there but soil. And it smells dead, too.
But you can float.
Right. The salt, the saline count of the water just lifts you, go right up to the top. You could almost emotionally walk on the water. Like, emotionally do that. But it's really that buoyant there because of so much salt, which kills everything. So the banks of the Dead Sea, now you know what that kind of looks like. It's literally just mud. And not the mud that can grow things, the mud that kills everything, because there's nothing living there. It's all salty. No plants. All the way up, high above the edge of the bank. That Dead Sea is also shrinking day by day. Its water level is decreasing because they're sending less and less water into it because it's going off to irrigation. So that image there kind of creates the groundwork for us to think about the overall picture of everything. Narrowing in and starting thinking about how these cities interact with the history, we're going to try to kind of blaze our way through. But it's okay, because if we don't finish it, we'll come back to it at another time. This is going to be part of our study when we go into 1st and 2nd Chronicles. We'll look at this history more in detail then. It'll have a lot more of this kind of content for us. But if you remember, in the cycle of the first three kings of Israel, who are those first three kings?
Saul, David, and Solomon.
And what's the rise, like what changes in the kingdom from King 1, 2, to 3? Under King Saul, what's going on in the kingdom? What's the primary thing that takes place? David's place in that space is big. But mainly it's give us a king. And he got a king. They got the kind of king they wanted, but not the king they needed. And so a kingdom is established in that first king. Second king, we get David. There's two things that happen in his kingdom that are kind of important. One of them is that this Davidic line starts to appear. Jesus shows up as a seed. But also, David builds the kingdom. And what does he use to build his kingdom? The sword, blood. David's kingdom is built and bathed in blood. So much so that he doesn't get to do something, right? He didn't go build the temple. Who builds the temple?
Solomon
builds the temple. And so the united kingdom, Saul, David, Solomon, has give us a king, built by blood, and the temple. There's a lot of other stories. A lot of other biblical events take place. But if you start thinking about how all of that plays in, into our map again here, you'll start thinking, okay, yeah, I can kind of gather that. This is, again, the divided kingdom map. We'll see the other one pop up a few times where things are a little bit different, but the cities are all there. So David builds out this power base and pushes everything out, and many of these cities actually appear on the map. Because remember, Solomon and David build cities. They build two types of cities. Some of their cities are called storehouse cities, and that's basically where we're going to put all the stuff. That they're going to hold up grain for bad years, etc. And some of the cities are built in conjunction with the law and defense. So they either are serving a civil or a spiritual purpose. Civil as this is now a defensive city, or spiritual as we're making sure we have the Levitical cities kept up. And David strengthens those cities in his kingdom. When we enter this period of the divided kingdom, we remind ourselves that both of these kingdoms would have been absolutely fine. Ooh, I must have clicked a lot more numbers than I planned. All right. There. They would have been absolutely fine had they sought the Lord. They would have been blessed as individual peoples. And yet, that wasn't their goal. And you see how all of this plays out, particularly if we start paying attention to how this dynamic plays out between Bethel and Dan. Bethel becomes the focal point for our future centerpiece of spiritual Israel in that place. And for our reminder point, what makes one of the many differences between the two kingdoms? Southern kingdom, still worshiping God at the place. In this case, the place had shifted from the tabernacle to the temple, with a physical temple being built. Prior to the building of the temple, the worship was centralized with the tabernacle. The temple's addition to their culture stabilized it right there. Did you guys notice some things important to you on your map? You can add right there. You can say, hey, this is Northern Kingdom. This is Southern Kingdom, roughly. This divided space is here. Now you can see that Dan is above, or a little below up here, above the Sea of Galilee, or Kinneret. And you can kind of catch how tightly edged Bethel and Jericho is to a number of other key biblical sites. Something takes place both inside the biblical record and in antiquity that's interesting with this change. Levites migrate. You begin to see less and less Levites in the biblical accounts of the northern kingdom. They're never mentioned. And in antiquity and writings outside the biblical canon, they all attest to Levites abandoning this region. And you start thinking about how that plays out for a people. Levites have a specific task for the various communities, right? They have a set of things they're supposed to do. So the geography of the region satisfies that by allowing Levites to be interspersed into these various nations. Their roles were both ceremonial and explicitly relational to God, in that they did things that were for outside show, the show God's work was being done, but they were offering sacrifices and engaging in those aspects of worship as needed. But when that vessel goes away, that opportunity, that role goes away, that whole geographic region is now not served by that option, that opportunity. What we don't know and don't necessarily see expressed in the text is this. Was it reactionary or because of conflicts of over ideology? In that, were people leaving because other gods were worshipped and the Levites weren't welcomed there? Or were they pushed out? They reacted and said, no, you got to get out of here. The history doesn't give us a clear enough answer to that kind of complex question. We just kind of know that these things happened in that context. really takes place for about 200 years. And hopefully, as we scooch along, I've got a couple of charts at the end that give us a combination timeline of the kings and years to kind of see how this plays out. Before we scooch any more, any questions or things that are of interest to each of you? Kind of thinking about this first step of the picture, big map, kingdom now split roughly. We say about divided, but it's not really half. It's heavily tribally connected, but it's really spiritually halved. You have the half or the remnant that wants to follow God more so, and the half that seems to want to just do whatever they want. All right. This is the connector point. You'll notice that the kings and their kingdoms are very much kind of connected to how their attitude was towards God's place in their lives and their service. The southern kingdom really tracks its outcome through David and Solomon. And you'll notice, you might remember from last week when we talked about the list of the kings. In the southern kingdom, you had far more kings who were trying to do good. And in the northern kingdom, you really didn't have that. Especially if we limit our metric to the high places and idolatry, it's pretty clear there's a huge gulf between those two places. All right. So you kind of zoom in a little bit on what's going on here. And what you have in this section gives you a little bit brighter look of things during the time of Jeroboam. And so this kind of gives you a middle space look. You'll notice that most of the topography is basically the same. You know, there's not big changes there where any of the land masses are moved. These maps don't show those kind of things. But there's a few mountains that are showing up that weren't necessarily identified before because they weren't part of the story. But you begin to see closely here in this place the shrinking of the kingdom. If and when we go back to the other map that includes both the United Kingdom and the Divided Kingdom, you can see the erosion of the island that was once the might of Israel, and as the edges of it are washed off. Judah itself, though, becomes, and that's the part of this map, they become landlocked. The trade routes go around them. Hill country and other mountain ranges kind of separate them and give them some level of separation from the idolatry that surrounded them. So that kind of sets that stage before we now talk about a few more big things. But let me show this real quick. Yeah, this should come in really good. So this is our two kingdom maps, which is the next part of the comparison space. So we've got on my right our divided kingdom space, right? You can see what's going on with the reduction in Israel on my left, as I'm facing at your left as well. You've got David and Solomon. Little tiny bits of Philistia and Phoenicia, kind of on the coastal edges, still in existence at different parts of their reign. But you can see how far the reach of space that David pushes to, right? That helps us visualize this difference. So let me ask you this question. Biggest state in the United States is what?
Alaska.
The Texans say, what's the Texan answer to that question? Wait till the snow melts. That's the Texas answer to that question. So when we look at our maps, we look at Texas, and Alaska is like, is it a state? What do we do with it? Like 1948? You know, it's a state. It's massive, right? But it's not our vision. So Texas, big. How big is Rhode Island? Like, Do you have, like, if you're using the little maps, you're like, zoom, 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 zoom. It's like five fingers. That's like five finger zooms is kind of how I might use it on a device, right? So if I can see Texas, and I have to zoom into it, who's going to win in a fight? The Texans know the answer to this question, right? Texans always going to win because we're bigger, right? That's the Texan motto for that. That's in part what you're seeing with this map. That the might of Israel, that was once the most powerful nation regionally, empowered by God and fueled by his blessing, is eroding because of their idolatry. And so the map tells that story as much as the text. Sometimes we think about geography as, well, that means I need to know where the mountains are, and I can use that to figure out who had the high ground. Because we know you can't beat somebody who has the high ground, right? That's like a fact. You can't win, I have the high ground. It's not really true, but that's what we think. Topography is that, but that's not geography. Geography is seeing all these things together. And so when you think about the geography of Israel, you think about A, its central river stream, its fact of mountains, the lakes, its presence next to the Big Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and how that changed over time. America does the same thing, and we kind of remember that, right? We bought places with cash and with blood to make America. Some stuff we fought for, and then other places we bought after someone else fought for it, right? The Louisiana Purchase and that whole great westward push. It's a mix of blood and cash that gets you there. So that's no different than this. But we don't all have on our memories, again, the last little point for this, every single topographical region of the United States and can tell you how to get there. But we have a map. So my encouragement to you then to think about this is just to remember, hey, you've got a map. And something that's fun to do is when you're reading these Bible stories, open up the map to the part you're reading and read a little bit and look at the map. And read a little bit and look at the map. Because most of the Bible stories are less about a zoomed in community in this sense than they are about these interplays of nations and how the nations relate to one another. In this case right now, focused in on the kingdom. All right, let me bring up this fun map. It's a map of a different kind. It's a time map as opposed to a physical map. Timelines or time maps. So we have three sections of this right here. And what this does is it kind of gives us the sequence of the kings and makes a fair guess overlay. I want to make two caveats to this. First caveat or explainer. The timelines on the bottom. Realize that no matter what anyone tells you, there's a level of guesswork involved and trying to get those numbers right. The guesswork involved includes some things that are very difficult to pinpoint because we don't have two things. A continual calendar timeline that has been found in antiquity that actually lists all these out in order for us. What we have is bits and pieces of information that we kind of take and put the puzzle pieces together in the way that seems right. We do know the order of the kings. We do know approximate other events. But don't get tied up on 1050, 1000, 950. And say, well, it's got to be here. Everybody's making guesses. And so if you're trying to take these guesses and connect it to broader history, they're making guesses too. Like they're making just as many guesses, if not more, than we have to do to try to roughly calibrate it. And so it's plus or minus. Just like the date of the birth of Christ is plus or minus. Like even our calendar says now that it's like plus three and to a certain degree. And more likely it should be like plus or minus within a range. So just keep that in mind. So we've got our United Kingdom that lasts, according to our little particular there, about 120-ish years. Remember, 40 years. Trying to present it as good kings, even though not necessarily good kings. But roughly, three kings, 120 years. And then we split. And you begin to see the relative chaos that it is these kingdoms, where you have co-rules and overlaps and gaps between some of these things, and they kind of appear at different points. On this chart here, and by the way, if you want, I can email you any of these three charts, and you can have your own copy later, so you don't have to copy them down in detail. Or we can print some out here if you'd like one. So this begins to show us our overlapping areas. If you see a little notch, it means that either the reigns overlapped in that area, or someone was serving as what we call a co-regent. You had basically an adult or a powerful person reigning as king, while someone who was younger or less powerful was growing up or gaining power to become king. So in our space from around 920, 930, moving up to 850, you see these different reigns laid out. What I find neat about doing this exercise is you can see how different kings' reigns kind of either matched one another or didn't. In this case, the reign of Asa is extensively long in that period, far longer than anyone else in that time frame in either of the kingdoms. This also covers the major chunk of time before captivities begin. Because in our next little setup, we get the beginning hints of captivity for our northern kingdom, going off into Assyria approximately 722. But then you also see a whole lot more overlapping rules and reigns taking place. And again, these are approximate overlaps, but they're pretty close. This kind of roughly approximates internal to the biblical text how they would have lined up. And so you can kind of see who's in king at different places. Information like this is useful when you're trying to sort out the two-act play or the two-scene or two-camera story that Kings becomes. How many of you guys remember watching the sitcom The Odd Couple? You guys remember that sitcom The Odd Couple where you have these two guys living together who are absolutely opposites? Their whole set was one big room, right? We didn't really see much of anything else. And so that single camera view became all you really saw, was them at home griping about stuff. Well, if you have a two camera view, you might have that set and a different one. And so in the biblical story, especially with the divided kingdom, you bounce back and forth from two places. Visually in a movie or a television show, you can tell when the scene changes, right? They were in the saloon, and now they're out on the wagon. The scene changed. Something's happened. In the Bible story, you know what happens for us? We might get a header. We might get an introduction that says there's a new verse. And so we sometimes have trouble sorting out which king, which kingdom, what time frame, especially if their names repeat, or even they sound as similar. So a chart like this is a tool to help us when our brains do that. Where are we? When are we? What am I supposed to do? Why am I here? Those kind of questions. So a chronology of the kings, this kind of time map or timeline, sorts some of that out. And it also helps us see the sequence of what's going to happen. So at 722, our good old timestamp, is really the demise of our northern kingdom, and we see our Assyrian captivity begin to occupy the text. That's not the end of the story, because there's a little bit more, right? We have a Babylonian and a Persian shift that will take place. So somewhere around 612, the Babylonians and the Medes arrive on the scene, finally culminating in Babylonia taking the southern kingdom as well. And all that story closes out with the final fall of the southern kingdom. So there you have all of our kings. Last week we talked about their reigns in regard to good king, bad king, and roughly examined some of that. This time what we've talked about is the land in which they habited briefly and kind of reminded ourselves that we kind of know what's going on. But now we've laid this other event where, in a sequence, three steps in this case, Israel will go into captivity. But it's not all Israel, right? Who goes into captivity? From the 12 tribes, how much of that actually becomes slaved to the foreign nations? Is it everybody?
The useful people.
In the end, it's the cream of the crop. When it's the northern section, it's not so much the useful people, it's the available people. And they've already become, in the way the Bible story represents them, less than useful. What have they lost before that happened? They lost their Levites. They lost their power, and they lost their way. But they're still brought into captivity. When we get to the southern kingdom, they also had lost their way. They also had lost their power. And God is taking away their Levites and their leaders. They all get stripped down to the same point. And only thing that's left in Israel are whomever the captors would say, yeah, you're not worth bringing back into to put to work. Like, you're not worth that effort. Whether they would die on the journey, whether there was just not whatever, that's the picture. That's the image that's there. So that kind of like seals that picture up for us in some ways. Let me ask some questions. Not so much what you liked about maps and charts and stuff, but when you think about how you study 1st and 2nd Kings or any biblical book, what do you like to do at home in your home Bible study? What's your method? I'm asking a different question you didn't plan for. This is the actual test part. Like, what's your favorite method of studying at home?
I'm just reading and meditating on what I've read.
Yeah, that's an echo of biblical concepts. That's the Psalms talk often about to read and then consider, or read and meditate. Keep in mind that the term meditate doesn't have its only exclusive connection to Eastern religions. It just means sitting down and thinking. Like, let's sit down and think about it. Great option. How many of you like to do your study in the morning? A lot of us like to do that for lots of good reasons. Some of it is habit forming, because I know if I do it in the morning, I'm less likely to not be interrupted in that process. Something I like to really do is to listen to the Bible read to me. There's two reasons why I like to do that. Well, maybe three. Reason number one is I don't get to do, like, I'm usually reading it. And so on a personal level, I like to have the Bible read to me. And so I'll put in the Bible being read and listen to it and rewind it and listen to it again and rewind it and listen to it again, because I don't get to do it. And secondly, it helps me properly pronounce everything. And for me, later during the day, I can do that and something else if I have to. It can be in my ears and I can be listening to it. So that's one of my favorite things to do on that area. What else? Well, for me, there's one other thing. Aside from doing that kind of reading it while listening, I really enjoy making my notes. I'm a note taker when I read. When I'm reading intently, I apply heavily the squirrel. Have I mentioned the squirrel before? You guys remember the squirrel? The squirrel is the study method of my preference. Squirrels are very distractible, right? Like, and they distract us. This squirrel doesn't do that. So whenever I'm studying or reading anything, the first thing I do is I survey it. I look at that chapter, and if it's got chapter headings, or I know what's in there, my survey says, this is that. If I'm reading 1 Timothy chapter 3, what's in 1 Timothy chapter 3? Elders and deacons, right? So my survey says that's what's in there. And then I'm going to say, do I have any questions after that survey that I hope to have answered? any questions I might have about it. Like, I didn't know that, or I've always struggled to understand this. Or in Genesis chapter 6, if we're back in that passage, I always am curious of how I'm going to think about the sons of God and what did God mean about that in that text. Those are my questions. That's the Q. And the R is careful or close reading. That's not listening to it in my ear. That's slowing down, carefully reading each word, and trying to pay attention to what the big sentence means in the translation I like to use. And then the last, the L of the squirrel, is to listen. Go to Bible class, ready to be a good student, ready to sit down and study together. And guess what? You know who listens a lot? Teacher. I listen to you guys all the time. I'm listening to your questions. I'm listening to your body language. I'm listening to your suggestions. And just as much as y'all listen, I have to listen too. So that distractible squirrel is my methodology. Then I might throw in the maps, I might throw in some history, I might throw in some other stuff, but it starts with a summary survey, questions I have, a careful reading, and then I get ready to listen. And that could also mean reverting back to my just listening to the Bible being read to me over and over again, if that's for personal development space. Anything you guys want to mention? We've got 2 minutes left before our class time escapes us and Les hits the buzzer and we have to close out. Things that were important to you. I'll add this, though. If you want a copy of those charts, just let me know. Any of those, I'm happy to print out for you tonight or email over to you. All right, I think next week and the week following, you'll have the far more easy to look at version of the Martin boys teaching Bible class the next two Wednesdays, so you don't have to look at this grumpy old face, and Jesse will be teaching. He'll have his subjects ready in advance, and you should get a notification of that before each week, but also it'll show up on Sunday as well, and he'll let us know what those two subjects are going to be for those next two Bible classes. I'm sure you guys will be making it fun for him, and I know he'll try his very best to provide a good class for all of you. Thank you again for your participation, and looking forward to all the other advantages we get to study together with. Thanks.